On the show today, the United States finally has a Speaker of the House.
He hasn't yet been a chairman of any influential House committees, and he's only been in Congress for three terms. So this is certainly an unusual rise to power.
Plus, what will Iran's support of Hamas and other anti-Israel groups mean for its nuclear program?
There was room for direct negotiations towards the end of October between Iran and the U.S. in Oman. But that, I think, is now completely off the books, and there is probably no political space left for direct engagement between the two countries.
And later, the Prime Minister of Australia is visiting Washington. We'll have an update from the White House. Today is Thursday, October 26th, and this is VOA's International Edition. From VOA headquarters in Washington, I'm Steve Karish. An update on Israel and Hamas coming up in a moment, but first, an update on events in Washington. After 3 weeks of negotiations and voting, Republicans in the U.S. House of Representatives have finally elected a Speaker of the House, Mike Johnson of Louisiana. But what do we know about Mike Johnson, and what can we expect from him as House Speaker? To find out, I spoke with VOA's congressional correspondent, Catherine Gibson.
So Mike Johnson was one of the lower-level members of House Republican leadership. He ranked below Steve Scalise, who you may remember was also a candidate for Speaker of the House 2 weeks ago. He hasn't yet been a chairman of any influential House committees, and he's only been in Congress for three terms. So this is certainly an unusual rise to power in terms of the speakership. We haven't seen somebody really come from the back benches and come to this position that's second in line for the presidential succession, and really will now be part of intelligence briefings. We'll have nuclear codes. We'll have a lot of responsibility very quickly. So it'll be interesting to see how he deals with that.
Is there a sense among Republicans that they had to do something right away?
I think after the turnover on Tuesday, when Tom Emmer was designated as Speaker by the House Republican Conference, and then within a matter of hours, largely because of former President Donald Trump criticizing him, had to withdraw that candidacy. I think there was a sense that there was fatigue over all of this, and that they really needed to get back to work, get back to figuring out aid to Israel, aid to Ukraine. You know, of course, we also have the short-term government funding bill expiring on November 17th. If they don't figure that out, then the government will close. So, yes, I think after the rapid turnover of Tuesday, there was definitely a sense that this needed to get done.
So, in a sense, it was more important to fill the seat than it was to fill the seat with the absolute right person.
Well, I think it also, in the minds of many more conservative Republican members of the House, this is a great choice for them. You know, Johnson has a very strong record of being anti-abortion, anti-gay marriage. He's a strong evangelical Christian. A lot of other members were saying that this hails the rise of the MAGA right, that we're finally seeing a real Donald Trump supporter rise to a position of power within the U.S. House of Representatives. So I think it was a mix of the two factors.
Well, that sort of brings up my next question is, what can we expect from his speakership? What kind of bills will he put forward? What kind of policies does he endorse?
Well, one of the first things he did as speaker was bring up a resolution condemning Hamas's attack on Israel and expressing the U.S. Congress's need to get behind Israel and support them. We know that he has proposed another short-term government funding deal that would push the issue out into early next year so that they can actually get to work on the actual appropriations bills and figure out real spending levels, which is always a priority for Republicans to make those spending cuts and try to be fiscally responsible. They want to buy more time to make those negotiations with a Democrat majority Senate and, of course, Biden in the White House. So that's going to be the first order of business for a Mike Johnson speakership.
My last question for you, Catherine. The House of Representatives is just under 50% Democrat as well. What's their sense of Johnson and what's their sense of moving forward and getting stuff done in a bipartisan way?
Well, you know, President Biden, in his statement on the election of Johnson, said that he was willing to work with anyone to get the work of the American people done. Minority Leader Hakeem Jeffries said something much along the same lines. But really, they're very interested in how this is going to play out to the 2024 midterm elections. They are saying that Johnson is an extreme member of the right, that he is a Donald Trump supporter through and through, and that his extremist policies are not going to appeal to the American people at large. They're already saying that this is going to be a key campaign issue, arguing that he tried to overturn the results of the 2020 election, and that is something that doesn't sit well with the majority of American people. So it's going to be tough for them to work with somebody whose underlying values they simply do not agree with.
Catherine Gibson is VOA's congressional correspondent. Catherine, thanks for your time. Thanks for your reporting on this.
So good to be with you.
Israel is preparing a ground invasion of Gaza, Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu said in a televised statement on Wednesday, though he declined to provide any details. He said the decision on when forces would go into the Palestinian enclave controlled by Hamas would be taken by the government's special war cabinet, which includes the leader of one of the centrist opposition parties.
We are raining hellfire on Hamas. We've already killed thousands of terrorists, and this is only the beginning. Simultaneously, we are preparing for a ground invasion. I will not elaborate on when, how, or how many. I will also not elaborate on the various calculations we're making, which the public is mostly unaware of, and that is how things should be.
Israel has carried out days of intense bombing of the densely populated Gaza Strip following the October 7th Hamas attack on Israeli communities that killed some 1,400 people. More than 6,500 Palestinians have been killed in the bombardments, this according to Gaza's health ministry. Earlier, citing U.S. and Israeli officials, the Wall Street Journal reported that Israel has agreed to delay the invasion of Gaza so that the United States could rush missile defenses to the region. All this as the UN warned on Wednesday that the Gaza Strip is on the verge of running out of fuel, forcing the UN to sharply curtail relief efforts. Meanwhile, the leader of Lebanon's Hezbollah group held talks on Wednesday in Beirut with senior Hamas and Palestinian Islamic Jihad leaders in a meeting of three of the top anti-Israel militant groups amid the war raging in Gaza. Their goal, according to a statement carried on Hezbollah-run and Lebanese state media, was to achieve a real victory for the resistance in Gaza and Palestine and halt Israel's treacherous and brutal aggression against our oppressed and steadfast people in Gaza and the West Bank. As tensions in the Middle East escalate following the Hamas attack on Israel and Israel's subsequent bombing of Hamas targets in Gaza, the future of Iran's nuclear program remains unresolved. As Henry Ridgewell reports, the West sees Tehran as the major backer of Hamas, and the group's attack on Israel has set back efforts to de-escalate tensions with Iran.
Western leaders see Iran as the major supporter of Hamas militants, but have not accused Tehran of direct involvement in the group's October 7th cross-border attack on Israel. Prior to the attack, relations between the West and Iran had been cautiously improving. In September, the United States struck a prisoner swap deal with Tehran and released $6 billion of frozen Iranian assets. That money has since been refrozen. Ali Vaez is an Iran analyst at the International Crisis Group in Washington.
There was room for direct negotiations towards the end of October between Iran and the U.S. In Oman. But that, I think, is now completely off the books. And there is probably no political space left for direct engagement between the two countries.
Talks in Vienna to revive the 2015 Iran nuclear deal, the Joint Comprehensive Plan of Action, or JCPOA, stalled last year, though neither side has said it is officially finished. The United States pulled out of the JCPOA in 2018, and Iran stopped complying with its commitments soon after. The UN's nuclear watchdog, the International Atomic Energy Agency, said in its August report that Iran was continuing to enrich uranium up to 60% purity, short of 90% weapons-grade fuel. Iran has removed IAEA monitoring equipment and has blocked some inspectors from visiting the country. Again, analyst Ali Vaez.
As part of the escalatory understanding between Iran and the U.S., Iran stopped accumulating additional 60% enriched uranium. Well, that might now change given the rising tensions between the two sides. It would take Iran less than a week to enrich enough uranium for a single nuclear weapon. And that's why this is literally a ticking bomb. There needs to be a solution one way or another to curb Iran's nuclear activities.
IAEA Chief Rafael Grossi said he saw no correlation between the Israel-Hamas war and Iran's nuclear program. Peter Jenkins is a former British ambassador to the IAEA.
There's still no evidence that Iran is contemplating a move away from compliance with its essential nuclear non-proliferation treaty commitment, which is to refrain from manufacturing nuclear weapons.
Could Tehran seek to use its nuclear program as leverage against the West as tensions increase in the region? Again, Peter Jenkins.
I can imagine them looking for ways of increasing concern and anxiety in the West about their nuclear program, but stopping short of actually, shall we say, crossing the line and ceasing to be in compliance with the Nuclear Non-Proliferation Treaty.
Meanwhile, Israel has repeatedly said it would not allow Iran to develop a nuclear weapon. Israel itself is widely believed to have atomic weapons, though it does not allow IAEA inspections of its nuclear sites. Henry Ridgewell, VOA News, London.
And here are some more stories we're following from around the world. Weather forecasters say Hurricane Otis made landfall Wednesday morning on Mexico's southern Pacific coast as a potentially catastrophic Category 5 storm. Mexico's Army and Navy deployed thousands of troops to the area with specialized equipment to aid in rescues. The Guerrero state government said it was preparing nearly 400 shelters in anticipation of families being driven from their homes by wind or surging waters. Donald Trump was called to the witness stand and fined $10,000 on Wednesday. This after the judge concluded that the former president had violated a limited gag order by commenting publicly on court personnel in his civil fraud trial. It was the second time in less than a week that Trump was penalized for his out-of-court comments. And in Nairobi, the Chief Justice of Kenya has sent a proposal to Parliament that calls for removing the death penalty for the crimes of murder, violent theft, and treason, saying the proposed changes aim to put the country's laws more in line with international human rights standards. Much of the world's attention has been on the situation between Israel and Hamas in the Gaza Strip. However, the broader conflict between Israelis and Palestinians also includes the West Bank and the roughly 3 million Palestinians who call it home. What has life been like there in the days after Hamas launched a deadly incursion into southern Israel? VOA's Rick Pantaleo spoke with correspondent Jan Boychat, who is reporting from the West Bank and has this update.
Jan, you told me that you spent days in the West Bank and you attended a funeral today. You also mentioned that there's a lot of rage and frustration over there and a lot of criticism about the way the Palestinian Authority have been dealing with all of this, trying to avoid a confrontational approach to Israel. Can you share some of what you're experiencing or what you're seeing on the West Bank?
Yes, I was today in this funeral, a 16-year-old boy. He was killed by the Israeli forces. So far, more than 100 Palestinians have been killed in the West Bank by the Israeli forces and by Jewish settlers that live there. Talking to people there, most of them, they say it's time to change the approach towards Israel. They've been criticizing Mahmoud Abbas, the Palestinian Authority president, because he's been trying for the last 30 years to find a solution through negotiation, trying to convince the international community that they have to step in this situation to find a solution for the Palestinian issue. But in the last 30 years, things are getting worse and worse for the Palestinians. They're losing land in the West Bank. Gaza is under a very strong blockade for the last 15 years. So a lot of people in the West Bank are just saying, we need to change. We need to find another way. And for a lot of people, another way means violence, means confrontation. So there's a very tense feeling and a fearful feeling as well for the people there. They do believe the war will reach them the same way it's reaching the Gaza people right now.
And from what I've read, Palestinian officials are saying that Israel launched drone strike on the West Bank, killing 3 people and injured more than 20 others. They're saying that the attack came after Israeli forces conducting a raid in the territory came under fire near the Jenin refugee camp.
Exactly. It's been happening for the last days. As I said, since the war between Israel and Hamas started, more than 100 Palestinians have been killed. A lot of them in operations like the Israeli forces entering refugee camps, entering some Palestinian cities to try to arrest people they say are connected to Hamas. This morning, in this place that I was, in the Kalandia refugee camp, that what happened, like the Israeli forces entered this refugee camp to arrest some people they say they were connected to Hamas, and people there, they start fighting back, throwing stones, but some people probably with guns as well. And this young boy was killed. So this is something that is happening in the last 2 weeks, and it's fueling the anger in the West Bank.
And finally, I've read that hundreds of demonstrators, including members of various Palestinian unions and federations, marched on Wednesday in Ramallah, located within the West Bank, to protest against the Israeli military strikes in Gaza. What do you know about that?
Oh, that's been happening in the last 2 weeks. There are protests all the time in Ramallah. Some of them are very violent. Especially the young people are confronting the Israeli forces that are around. Last Friday, for example, I was in one of those protests, and there was a lot of violence. I saw at least 6 guys were shot with live ammunition by the Israeli forces. And the fear is that this violence can escalate there after all this violence that is going on everywhere around here.
If you don't mind me asking, Jan, how are you coping with all this going around you?
It's very sad to see what's going on. Here, I think it's easier. I have good friends working in Gaza now, Palestinian people who live there that I met at the time. And I think the situation there is catastrophic. I have the chance to leave. I can go when I feel I can go, but a lot of people, they can't. Mm-hmm. So I have to cope with this in a good way, because I have the chance to leave whenever I want to leave. So it's very different.
Jan, thank you very much for joining us. I appreciate it.
Thank you very much for having me.
From Washington, it's VOA's International Edition. I'm Steve Karish. Australian Prime Minister Anthony Albanese visited the White House for a state visit on Wednesday. The pageantry-filled day offered a chance for the two nations, who are already close, to deepen their cooperation around nuclear-powered attack submarines and their joint military presence in the Pacific Islands. Both moves seen as critical to countering China's increased ambitions. VOA's Anita Powell reports from the White House.
President Joe Biden warmly welcomed Australian Prime Minister Anthony Albanese to the White House on Wednesday, acknowledging that the state visit was overshadowed by gruesome events on the other side of the globe.
Together, we're standing with Israel against Hamas terrorism. We're standing with Ukraine against Putin's tyranny. And we're providing and proving that democracy can deliver on the challenges that matter most to people's lives, from climate change to cancer.
Albanese highlighted those conflicts to emphasize that the two English-speaking liberal democracies hold shared ideals.
In today's uncertain world, the alliance between Australia and the United States and the way that we stand steadfast against aggression, whether it be Russia's illegal invasion of Ukraine or whether it be Hamas's terrorist attack on Israel, is something that can be relied upon for us to stand up for our common values.
Biden said the visit offered the two a chance to double down on their country's cooperation, which includes technological, scientific, and military endeavors. The two also cited their efforts to counter a shared adversary, China, with Biden warning Beijing about its recent harassment of Philippine vessels in the South China Sea. Any attacks, he said, would invoke the U.S.'s mutual defense treaty with the Southeast Asian archipelago. Earlier in his term, Biden forged a trilateral security partnership with Australia and Britain, called AUKUS, which calls for enhanced military interoperability and assistance for Australia to acquire conventionally armed, nuclear-powered submarines. Analysts say all of this is being closely watched, not only by Beijing, Canberra, and Washington, but also by the region being courted by all three, the many diffuse island nations that dot the Pacific Ocean. Biden hosted many of those leaders at a forum last month. Gordon Peake is a senior advisor for the Pacific Islands at the U.S. Institute of Peace.
It's also be interesting to see how it plays out in the Pacific, which has got some leaders are lukewarmly for AUKUS, others are kind of ambivalent towards AUKUS. There's an awful lot of opposition to AUKUS within the region as well, particularly on there's the nuclear submarines, the fact that they are nuclear powered but conventionally armed.
Albanese soon embarks on another high-profile visit. He recently announced he'll visit Beijing and Shanghai in early November to meet with President Xi Jinping. Anita Powell, VOA News, The White House.
And that's going to wrap it up for us today. This has been International Edition on the Voice of America. On behalf of everyone at VOA, thanks for joining us. For pictures, stories, videos, and more, follow VOA News on your favorite social media platform or on voanews.com. Until next time, I'm Steve Karish in Washington. Stay safe and have a great day.
Next, an editorial reflecting the views of the United States government.
There has been significant democratic backsliding in the Sahel, including recent coups in Mali, Guinea, Burkina Faso, and now Niger. There are several drivers of political instability in the Sahel, said Assistant Secretary of State for African Affairs Molly Fee in recent congressional testimony.
The primary problem is weak governance. Every country where a coup has taken place had previously experienced military takeovers. Many of these governments had engaged in corrupt practices, failed to provide basic services, and ignored democratic values by extending term limits or disregarding human rights. Such practices tested the presumption that democracy delivers.
Atrocities by the Islamic State and the branch of al-Qaeda known as JNIM and predations by criminal armed groups have placed unrelenting pressure on governments and civilians, said Assistant Secretary Fee. Military rulers point to the supposed failure of democracy to justify their actions, but military rule does not improve people's lives, underscored Assistant Secretary Fee.
In fact, military rule leaves populations poorer and less secure. The number of deaths from political violence increased by 150% in Mali and 77% in Burkina Faso in 2022. Violence targeting civilians in Mali increased by 38% this year, nearly a third of these incidents perpetrated by Malian security forces or the Wagner Group. Violent incidents in Niger rose by 42% in the month after the coup.
The United States is working to foster a return to democracy in the region, said Assistant Secretary Fee.
In the case of Niger, we are working closely with the regional organization ECOWAS. The African Union and Africa's regional economic commissions are essential partners in advancing peace and democracy. Secretary Blinken met with ECOWAS foreign ministers at the recent UN General Assembly to propose a phased approach to resuming U.S. assistance based on concrete actions to return the country to democratic rule. Committed to the Nigerian people, the United States has maintained humanitarian and basic health and food assistance.
The Sahel is integral to our relationship with the African continent, declared Secretary Fee. That's why the United States will continue to support a return to democracy throughout the region.
That was an editorial reflecting the views of the United States government.